The U.S. Treasury Secretary says the debt ceiling needs to be raised, but can it be done without another partisan showdown? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots to cover this hour on Politics Day. We'll hear about what's getting done in D.C. and what's not likely to get done before politicians are again entrenched in another election cycle. We also look overseas to updates on Mideast peace talks, Egypt, and China's recent economic slowdown. Our analysts, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, David Skidmore of Drake University. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. It starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again, one of the favorite hours of many of our listeners to chew over developments on the political landscape here in Iowa and abroad. Actually, we're going to be spending some time abroad this hour, as well as looking at Washington politics. Our analysts this hour, Donna Hoffman is with us in our Cedar Falls studio, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, great to have you in that seat.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. David Skidmore with us, professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. It's been a while. David, I'm so glad that you're joining us.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Donna.
Hello.
Let's, if we can, more or less look at the hour. We'll start off, if we could, with domestic politics and move on there. Donna, I'll lean a little heavier on you. And David, with your international expertise, I'll lean a little heavier on you in the second half hour as we talk about a number of things. Mideast peace talks, Egypt, China's recent economic slowdown. After we get to some areas of domestic politics, and we want to invite our listeners to join our conversation with any comments or questions you have about any of the political topics we'll be bringing up this hour. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can also post a message or question on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPRTalk. Let's go to Washington for the latest politics there. President Barack Obama made another attempt yesterday at reviving the so-called grand bargain. He called it a grand bargain for the middle class, and it involves cutting the corporate tax rate if Republicans agree to spend billions in one-time revenues to fund job creation projects that the president has long championed. Yesterday, in a speech, President Obama continued his push to control the details of negotiating what he calls a grand bargain.
So I'm going to try offering something that serious people in both parties should be able to support. A deal that simplifies the tax code for our businesses and creates good jobs with good wages for middle-class folks who work at those businesses. Right now, everybody knows this. Our tax code is so riddled with loopholes and special interest tax breaks that a lot of companies who are doing the right thing and investing in America pay 35% in their taxes. Corporations who've got fancy accountants and stash their money overseas, they pay little or nothing in taxes. That's not fair. And it's not good for the economy here.
President Obama on Tuesday. Today, Republicans not enthusiastic. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said today that it's a far left-wing plan that is not serious.
It really would be nice to see the president work with Congress for a change to get some important things done for the American people. Republicans have been eager to do this all along. But really, it's almost like there's a gone campaigning sign outside the Oval Office, a gone campaigning sign outside the Oval Office. And on the rarest of occasions, when he does come to the Hill, as he will today, you find out it's basically just another internal campaign rally with Democrats. So I hope he'll finally get serious and make one of his famous pivots, this time in a new direction, toward effective policy and away from the never-ending political sideshow.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell this morning. Donna Hoffman, tell us what's going on here with this new revival of the grand bargain. What's the strategy here by the administration?
Well, the administration certainly wants to get some kind of a deal. Previously, it's been called a grand bargain. You know, that's increasingly difficult. But we do have two things that are looming that the administration hopes to pressure congressional Republicans with. Congressional Republicans hope to pressure Obama with. Those are the debt ceiling increase, and then the fiscal year begins on October 1st. And so, you know, Obama makes his remarks, and in the clip that you played, he is kind of in campaign mode. I think you hear him speaking much less formally. He's dropping some G's there. He's hammering on some very populist themes, and he hasn't, you know, come right out and said it yet, send me a Democratic Congress in the midterm election that's coming up, but that's obviously what he's gearing up to. That's what he's getting to. And he wants to put pressure on congressional Republicans not to do things like shut the government down, be intransigent on the debt ceiling and those kinds of things. And so, I mean, it's really from the White House a strategy of trying to build some public support, some momentum on these things. You know, congressional Republicans came right out and said, you know, essentially these kinds of things are dead on arrival with us. Obama, you know, shot back, give us a plan. You haven't done that. And so it is very much a tit for tat, which is really not anything new that we've seen. And so the question becomes whether they will be able to work. We have seen some movement with some senators in the GOP in being a little more willing to say things negatively about GOP House members to signal some working with Obama, even on some other areas. So
yeah,
we may see.
What's going on there? Is there a split happening in the GOP? Is the divide and conquer perhaps working to some degree?
I think it might be because you have seen some prominent GOP members of Congress and even Tom Cole, who's in the House, say some things about, in particular, the strategy of, you know, defund Obamacare or the government gets it, which is kind of their strategy of some very conservative House Republicans, where they want to defund Obamacare and they're willing to shut down the government to do it, they're signaling, or they're willing to default on the debt, they're signaling. And, you know, what some people might call saner voices in the GOP have said, really not comfortable with doing that. Tom Coburn, also coincidentally from Oklahoma, but on the Senate side, you know, said, I'm all for defending Obamacare, but this is not the way to do it. Come up with a way to do it, and then we can go on. So there are some interesting cracks, I think, and some real differences between Senate GOPers and the conservative caucus within the House. Where John Boehner stands on this, he's kind of hedging his bets a bit at this point.
And if I remember correctly, I think some polling, Donna, that rolling back Obamacare is not, unless we talk about the core Republican constituency, the 30%, it's not a popular thing for the Republicans to run on, is it?
It's really not. Now, you can also look at polling numbers, though, that show that Obamacare is unpopular in a lot of ways. But what we have to understand about polling on Obamacare is that that issue is very complex and it's multifaceted. So when you poll on the kind of the pieces of Obamacare, oftentimes many of those turn out to be very popular. And so the you know, you have this issue of Republicans seriously wanting to get rid of that program, but the president is in place until, you know, January 20th at noon of 2017, and the House can symbolically take vote after vote after vote to repeal that, but it's not going anywhere. And the Senate is in Democratic hands, at least until the midterm election, obviously. So so there's a lot of this is, you know, positioning, and it is positioning for each party before the 2014 midterm elections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's pick up on one of the comments you said, looming out there in our political future for the country. Congress must deal with this continuing resolution measure currently funding the government, expiring, I believe, September 30th. Without a renewal, the government could shut down. This past weekend, the Treasury Secretary Jack Lew hit a number of some Sunday talk shows to reinforce the administration's position here.
Congress needs to do its work. It has to stop looking for what's the last possible moment. No one can predict with absolute accuracy, and they can't take the risk of making a mistake. They should get back after they take their time off in August, and they should finish their work and get it done so that there's no uncertainty about America's ability to pay its bills.
But House Speaker John Boehner already said this at a press conference. This was back in June.
Now, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling without real cuts in spending.
It's as simple as that. We need significant cuts in spending if we're going to replace the sequester and extend the debt limit. I believe that the so-called Boehner rule is the right formula for getting that done.
Okay, a reminder, the Boehner rule, any debt ceiling hike must be matched dollar for dollar with cuts. Donna, how do you see this developing?
Well, you know, there's two different issues there. They're a bit separate, but they are connected. One is funding the government for the fiscal year of 2014, which starts October 1. So if those and interestingly enough in the debate, and you even framed it this way, that continuing resolution has to be approved. Well, in the normal budget process, which we haven't seen for a number of years, we would be talking about the House and the Senate approving the 12 appropriations bills to fund the government. That's the normal process. They've pretty much given up on that, and they fund things by continuing resolution these days. And so if the bill to fund the government for the fiscal year isn't in place by October 1st, they have to use this the bills, they have to use this continuing resolution mechanism, which is what we expect them to do. So that's one issue. The other issue is sometime in mid-fall, we will be beyond the ability to pay our bills with the debt ceiling. We've actually already met the debt ceiling limit a couple of months ago. The Treasury Department's just doing some extraordinary things to make sure that we don't default. Mm-hmm. So those are separate issues, but they are certainly related. And, you know, the House GOP really wants to use those two things in particular as leverage to try to get the things that they want. Again, some of them to get rid of Obamacare or defund it anyway. And in Boehner's case, you know, he wants to see significant spending cuts. And there's issues of sequestration in there as well. So it's all very complicated. But, you know, in mid-fall or early fall, actually, these things have to be taken care of. And there does have to be some cooperation between the Democrats and Republicans to do this.
I wonder, when we think back to 2011 and the fight over the debt limit in that year, remind us what happened there, Donna, and how that might color what's going on right now. Is it, the fact that that was so partisan, such rancor, will that change what's going on?
I don't think it will change. I think you'll still hear a lot of partisan rancor. I do think they'll be a little more contemplative about how they go about this. The same people pretty much agree. And this is underneath a lot of the rhetoric that may be very inflammatory, but that walking us up to that debt default is not a good idea.
Right. When they did it, real harm to our economy.
Right. And in 2011, when they did it, a few days after they then passed the Budget Control Act, it was when our bond rating got downgraded for the first time ever, and the stock market became very volatile. And those are things that you will start to hear the administration talk about with the public in terms of, remember what happened the last time we walked up to this deadline. Bad things happened, and they will really try to prevent that from happening. But then again, it is something that the Republicans think they may have some leverage on. But again, that is also wrapped up in this in hearing some cooler heads prevail within the Republican caucus about maybe being a little bit more willing to do some things that would not harm the economy, but still trying to get as much as they can in terms of spending cuts.
David Skidmore, you've been listening. What is your perspective on this?
Well, one thing that occurs to me is that we always refer to the Republicans as the party of business. And yet, you know, business interests don't want to see us, go up to the debt limit and find our credit rating threatened, or they don't want to see the government closed down. We've also seen business interests coming together to support comprehensive immigration reform in recent years. And yet, House Republicans don't seem as responsive to those kinds of appeals as maybe they Republicans have traditionally. So I'm wondering, I was going to ask Donna, you know, are the business interest voices that traditionally have had a strong role in the Republican Party less important now?
I don't know that I would say less, but they certainly, they're still important. But, you know, when you're a House member and you're a Republican, you may have a district in which you're afraid of getting challenged from the right in a primary. And that may mean that you really need to hit on these, some of these red meat issues that your base likes that may not necessarily be attached to those traditional GOP business interests. And, you know, what we have seen, I think, a lot of times is business interests understanding the dynamic there and not being too vocal, at least, you know, in the public discourse about things. But we have seen, you know, there recently was a letter that business interest signed to the GOP saying, please do immigration reform. It's good. Right. You know, it would be good for business. So it really kind of, I mean, when you look at the strategy or the kind of the ideological background in some of the House Republican members, some of that is dictated by their district and maybe how they initially got elected. Maybe they were the person from the right that challenged a more establishment Republican, and they think they need to be true to what they told their constituents and how they got elected. And so there is certainly an interesting, and there always has been kind of the split within the GOP, the business interests and the more social issue interests.
But couldn't one argue, Donna Hoffman, to answer David's question too, that you can have a business interest that says, I don't want crippling debt and deficit to weigh on the economy. That's good for my business.
Oh, certainly. And I think you're increasingly going to hear those voices because it is certainly true that business writ large does not think that a default is a good thing. And by and large, most people in the country do not think that shutting down the government is a good thing. And so I think you do see, you will see pressure, but that pressure oftentimes has been behind the scenes. I think you may see the pressure from business interests coming more to the fore if they get really impatient with the GOP. And we have, you know, seen Obama do some things in terms of making inroads with business, you know, especially in putting together Obamacare. He got key business stakeholders, in particular the insurance industry, to get behind some of those things, which, you know, wouldn't have succeeded had he not done that. He's rolling out, you know, a business tax cut in the speech that he gave that you heard at the top of the show. And so he's, you know, trying to make some inroads there. And the more he can paint the GOP as simply being knee-jerk, everything I propose you are going to oppose, the more he, you know, makes inroads with some of the more traditional business constituencies of the GOP.
Let's pick up on another point that's been in our politics this past week or two. Banning abortions after a specific point in a pregnancy, it's become a popular trend in states this year. And last week, Republican Governor Rick Perry of Texas made his state the 12th state to ban most abortions after 20 weeks. Tell us, Donna, what you see going on here in terms of abortion law politics.
Well, this is a classic wedge issue that especially state parties right now, as you mentioned, are really trying to push. There's a couple of goals here. One's pretty clear that states are pushing this 20-week ban and have been successful in a number of states in an attempt to try to get this issue into the court system, to try to get a case or cases where the Supreme Court would reconsider the Roe v. Wade decision. And that's pretty clear. But what is not as clear is that in a lot of these measures that states are passing, they are also regulating abortion clinics in their state to the point that it is in many ways a backdoor attempt to simply get rid of abortion, period, in the state, because they are doing things like regulating the clinics and their physical the hallway size, for example, and the kinds of facilities that they have. Mm-hmm. They are making physicians that perform abortions in those facilities. They have to have admitting procedure or admitting credentials for a hospital within 30 miles, which would try to cut down on abortion providers coming into states where they don't want to live, quite frankly, because we have seen high-profile deaths of physicians that deliver this service.
And you mentioned the Supreme Court. Do you think that one of these state rules, these newly enacted ones, some of which you're describing right now, will be ruled on at one point by the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, they have to work their way into the system. They have to begin with the lower courts. For the Supreme Court to pick up a decision in this area, you will generally need to see appellate courts and maybe some district courts coming at the issue from different angles and having different decisions. Mm-hmm. And that is when an issue like this is ripe for the Supreme Court to take. But the Supreme Court does not have to take these kinds of issues. And it's not clear to me how ripe they are to revisit this issue. Mm-hmm. And so it will take some time for these to filter into the court system.
Interesting here, we have some new research on attitudes, regional disparities over the abortion issue, having grown during the past two decades. And this is leading to a widening gulf between the nation's most conservative and the most liberal regions. New research from the Pew Center, a survey reporting that the eight-state region, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma, they have grown significantly more conservative when it comes to abortion, opposition to legal abortion increasing by 12 percentage points since the mid-1990s. That's the biggest jump of any region in the nation over that period, noted by the Pew Research Center. Now, they're calling those the South Central states. New England, on the other end of the spectrum, support for legal abortion, growing by 5 percentage points in that same time period. So isn't that interesting, Donna?
It is interesting. It's perhaps not surprising. I mean, in those South Central states, you have seen the state legislatures in those states become dominated by Republicans. This is a signature Republican wedge issue. The more this issue is in the public, the more people think about the issue. I mean, people don't think about this issue every day, most people. But the more it is being talked about at state legislative levels, the more the people pushing particular legislation talk about it. You know, they come up with creative ways to label things, and then people start to it may start to resonate with people. They may start to think, oh, sure, that's reasonable. Mm-hmm. And so it's really not surprising necessarily that it breaks down regionally that way. There's aspects of political culture there as well. And, you know, nationally, if you look at attitudes, they haven't really shifted a whole lot. But there is that interesting shift in terms of certain regions. And some of that, I think, can be attributed to the kinds of political activity that you've seen, both in terms of who's getting elected and then the kinds of issues that they push that makes the public think about these issues. And, mm-hmm. and then, you know, we poll on them.
We have about a minute before we have to take a break. David, did you want to get in there?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Donna, do we see a trend where people are segregating themselves according to politics? In other words, we used to ask, you know, when we moved to a new city or new area, well, what are the schools like? What are the home prices like? We still ask those kind of questions, but do we also now ask, do I share the same political views as the people in this area, such that, certain cities, certain areas become much more homogenous politically? We don't have the mixing of Republicans and Democrats that we used to.
I think that's true to some respects. Now, some people are really going to do those kinds of things. Other people are not. But, you know, these things can also track other kinds of indicators like socioeconomic status, which, you know, we used to have a lot more mixed socioeconomic status in terms of living patterns. We have less of that now. And quite frankly, attitudes within the Republican Party, you know, it used to be possible to be a pro-choice Republican, but people have also sorted themselves in terms of those kinds of wedge issue ideologies as well. Mm-hmm. And that can affect housing patterns.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll be back with Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, David Skidmore of Drake University. In our second half hour, we're going to talk about the political fallout, if any, over the Bradley Manning verdict, but then also have David give us updates on Mideast peace talks, Egypt, also China's recent economic slowdown, repercussions there. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We hope you'll stay with us over this noon hour. This is Iowa Public Radio. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we'll remember one of our nation's most highly decorated servicemen, a man who, after his active military service, was a tireless advocate for veterans' rights. He was also a native of Iowa who grew up in Sioux City. This past Sunday, retired Colonel George Bud Day died at the age of 88. Medal of Honor recipient, spent 5.5 years as a POW in Vietnam, was Arizona Senator John McCain's cellmate, in fact. And tomorrow on this program, conversation with Master Sergeant John Sandman of the 185th Air Refueling Wing based in Sioux City, a friend of Colonel Day, will tell us about this great American tomorrow on the program. It's Politics Day, and our great analysts for this hour, Donna Hoffman, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Northern Iowa, David Skidmore, professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. And this half hour, shifting more of our focus abroad, I wanted to pick up on this, which straddles domestic and international politics, if we could, Donna and David, to begin with. Dave Bradley Manning, we heard this week, the former intelligence analyst who perpetrated the largest leak of classified information in U.S. history, acquitted of the most serious charge against him. The military judge presiding over the case found Army Private Manning not guilty of aiding the enemy when he released hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks, a charge that carried a possible punishment of life in prison. However, Manning was found guilty of other serious offenses, including multiple charges of espionage, five charges of theft. I wonder what your thoughts are, Donna and David, about this verdict, if there are any repercussions that we can see here. Donna?
Well, we've certainly seen the Obama administration try in a number of ways to cut down on leakers of kind of all types. And this is a pretty high-profile case, obviously, that aiding the enemy charge really was kind of, as I see it anyway, always a stretch on the part of the government's case because they were essentially arguing that by publishing these secrets for anybody to see, the world to see, that would include our enemies, our adversaries, and so that was aiding the enemy. And the military judge in that particular case rejected that, and which I think is probably the proper thing in terms of the government kind of overplaying its hand there. You know, really, though, what the government is seeking to do with this case, with what potentially they, want to do with Edward Snowden and then in some other leak cases, is really try to cut down and come down hard on leakers. And certainly this is kind of a mixed decision in that regard because he was convicted on several charges, but that most serious charge he was not convicted on.
Your thoughts, David Skidmore?
Well, it's not clear that the threat of long jail time is going to be enough to stop folks who, on the inside, who have objections to government policies and programs that are secret from the public and are willing to take risks to get that information out. Manning, I think, expected that he would probably get caught at some point and suffer repercussions. Snowden is now hiding in an airport in Moscow, and his future is very uncertain. So it's, under those kind of circumstances, it's not clear to me that a verdict like this is going to dissuade future leakers.
Mm-hmm. How did these two cases, the WikiLeaks case coming first, relate to each other, if at all, or did they just coincide in time?
Well, I think it's the WikiLeaks is a model. I think it represents a certain philosophy of a radical openness, and we have the technological ability to share massive amounts of information on the web, to distribute this across multiple servers so that it's almost impossible to shut it down once it's out, and. These are new circumstances that governments are going to have to face and deal with.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn our focus to the Mideast. Secretary of State John Kerry said yesterday Israeli and Palestinian negotiators would convene again in the Middle East within 2 weeks, that their goal would be to work out a comprehensive peace agreement within 9 months that would lead to an independent Palestinian state. Kerry putting a lot of energy, a lot of clout into making the peace talks start again. Here's John Kerry speaking at a State Department press conference yesterday.
The parties have agreed here today that all of the final status issues, all of the core issues, and all other issues are all on the table for negotiation. And they are on the table with one simple goal: a view to ending the conflict, ending the claims.
Okay, tell us, David Skidmore, any reason to think this is any different than other of the many attempts at Middle East peace? How much optimism should we have?
Well, the way you phrased your question sort of suggests that, it's it's right to be somewhat skeptical. We've had peace negotiations going on for decades now. There have been high points, there have been low points, and we still don't have a two-state solution.
What are the sticking points?
Well, there's sticking points over boundaries, over the status of Jerusalem, over the right of Palestinians to return to the homes that they were removed from in 1948, security for Israel, and it's not clear that there is a consensus in either Israel or among the Palestinians to make the concessions that either side would have to make in order for an agreement to emerge. I guess the hope here is that we'll have somewhat far-sighted leaders step forward, like Sadat of Egypt in 1979, or like Rabin in 1993, who will somewhat work against type. Is Prime Minister Netanyahu willing to basically challenge his right-wing coalition to step up to the plate and make historic compromises? Early during his presidency, President Obama tried to push the two sides towards negotiations, and it really blew up in his face, and it was kind of an embarrassing failure. He's making another push now. New Secretary of State John Kerry's invested a lot. But the political stakes are pretty high. A failure at this point would, the Middle East situation is already inflamed. We're going to have midterm elections coming up. Another embarrassment, which, most people would say is more likely than not, could be politically costly for the president.
Mm-hmm. At what point would the president step in personally, as we saw way back with President Carter in the 1970s, later with President Clinton? When does that investment get made? What conditions have to be there?
Well, I think that you have to get to a point where the two sides have shown a level of seriousness, where there has been progress, but, there's still some sticking points that will require the president to step in and put his prestige and weight on into the negotiations. If he can see that kind of effort might push the two sides over the finish line, then he might be willing to make that investment. Until that point, it will be John Kerry and the special envoy that's been named, Martin Indyk, sort of carrying the water on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn our focus to Egypt. Also, development there in recent days, Egypt allowing Europe's top diplomat, one Catherine Ashton, to meet the deposed Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. That was this past Monday, flown in after dark to Morsi's secret detention facility. But authorities in Egypt ruling out any role for him in ending the turmoil in that country. Ashton is the European Union's foreign policy chief, and she became the first outsider to see Morsi since he was deposed on July 3rd, taken into a detention, placed under investigation on charges including murder. How do you see this developing, David Skidmore?
Well, it's a very fluid situation. The new government has, on the one hand, said that they want to move as quickly as possible toward a new set of elections, and they've said that they're committed to restoring democracy and on an inclusive basis that would include the Brotherhood and the Islamist parties. On the other hand, in recent days, we've seen signs of a real crackdown, not just the continued detention of Morsi, but also arrests of many of the top officials in the Brotherhood and clashes in the streets leading to bloodshed, and now most recently declaration that the sit-in that's been carried out by the Brotherhood supporters will be closed down in some way.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like the Islamic Brotherhood will settle for anything less than the reinstatement of President Morsi, does it?
No, they've rejected the overtures from the government. They want Morsi back in power, which is not going to happen. You know, what would be the consequence of releasing Morsi at this point? It's you know, the Egyptian government is trying to figure out what's the lesser evil. As long as he's in detention, then people will be in the streets demanding his freedom. If he's free, that gives him an opportunity to rally supporters. So it's not clear how things will work out.
What is then the U.S. role in all this? What is going on? What should be the role in this sort of tricky situation? It seems this is one of those situations where the U.S. can't win, or what should be the role?
Yeah, every side in Egypt blames the U.S. Those who wanted Morsi to be overthrown believe that the U.S. has been backing the Brotherhood. Those who were involved in the coup believe that the U.S. is not providing them with enough support. So the U.S. is getting blamed by both sides, and I think it's partly because the U.S. doesn't have an overall strategy. It's not clear what our objectives are. It's not clear what leverage we have. It appears to be relatively little. And so we're mainly reacting to events as they come and without very much clarity.
Mm-hmm. What are the main U.S. concerns as you see them as we look at the Middle East and Egypt?
Well, the U.S. has had a long-term stake in making sure that the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt remains strong, and we're worried about the rise of militants in the Sinai area that borders on Gaza. So the U.S. wants to, you know, thinks that, you know, its relationship with Israel is also at stake here. Israel has said that the United States needs to continue aid to the present government, even though we have on the books a law that says that foreign aid and military aid will be withdrawn from any government that takes power through an illegal coup d'etat. We've refused to call it a coup, even though that's clearly what it is. So Israel's pressuring us to continue the ties with the government in hopes that that will give the military their incentive to continue to abide by the peace agreement it has with Israel.
Politics Wednesday, David Skidmore of Drake University with us this hour, along with Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's pivot from the Middle East in our international affairs over to China. John Kerry, Vice President Joe Biden has been traveling in the Southeast Asia recently. He says the U.S. He says that the U.S. wants China and other Southeast Asian countries to develop a code of conduct. There are ongoing negotiations between China and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Here's Vice President Biden in an interview with Bloomberg News this week.
What we want to see is that there no use of threat, intimidation, or force, that the rules of the road and international rules relating to international waters, sea lanes open and free. And so the ASEAN, as well as China, has agreed that they would sit down and begin to decide on a compact as to how to proceed. We are doing everything we can to encourage that to be done. But it has to be done. And it is, look, more of the commerce and intercourse of the world will traverse the the South China Sea, the East China Sea, the Indian. I mean, it is a major, major, major highway of commerce.
That's Vice President Joe Biden, ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, comes at a time when we hear that China's manufacturing industry has seen its growth slow down to an 11-month low in July. Job market weakening. A survey has revealed indicating that the world's second largest economy losing steam. Tell us what's going on in this area, David Skidmore, and what U.S. concerns are.
Well, let's start with the economic news. There are really two stories here. The first story is a kind of short-term problem that China has, that housing prices have been have been booming, and there's worry that, there's a bubble similar to the one that the United States had in back in 2007, 2008, and that the bubble at some point might burst as you know, if prices rise too high. So the government has been trying to gradually reduce the amount of credit that's flowing into the housing market, hoping that prices will get back to more reasonable levels in a gradual, controlled manner. And so it's been cutting back on some of the growth in the money supply and encouraging banks to adopt stricter lending rules. So that's one concern. A larger concern is that the overall growth model that China's been following for the last several decades seems to be running out of steam. That model has relied heavily upon very large levels of investment and infrastructure, on exports to the rest of the world. And, of course, we know many of the markets that China exports to are themselves not doing too well. It's relied upon a heavy reliance upon state-owned enterprises, these huge firms that are owned by the government. And there are worries that this model is not sustainable. So they're trying to shift toward a greater reliance on domestic consumption of Chinese-produced goods, free, you know, more market-oriented economic policies, encouraging private enterprise. And the problem here is that this threatens a lot of vested interests who have profited under the old model. So there's conflict going on within China over what its economy should look like going forward.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about the growth model for China over the past couple of decades running out of steam, what repercussions does that sort of downturn have potentially for the U.S. economy?
Well, you know, we talk a lot about Chinese exports to the United States, which are very large, but at the same time, we also export quite a bit to China. So if China's economy goes through a kind of controlled, gradual process of deflating this property bubble and getting to a sustainable level of growth, then, you know, that's fine. But there are worries that China's economy could crash, that there could be financial problems. As property values goes down, then the banks and developers whose borrowings have rested upon the collateral that's represented by those properties may not be able to pay back their debts as they come due. So if there were some kind of crash, that would, of course, hurt U.S. exporters to China. It would also hurt the many American corporations who are heavily invested in China and, you know, who will stand to lose should China's economy turn downward. Mm-hmm. So it could be significant.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Donna Hoffman, listening to this, if you can tell us sort of a domestic perspective on this. We, of course, China figures into a lot of domestic politics, campaign rhetoric, and so forth. How does what David is describing fit into our domestic politics?
Well, it's certainly always a concern as the, you know, world is increasingly, the world economy is increasingly, you know, interrelated domestically. You know, the policymakers have to watch what is happening in China because it's the second largest economy. That certainly is a concern. But, you know, at least right now, it's not something you're hearing a lot about because domestic policy is really something that trumps, you know, kind of the foreign policy. And that's especially true in elections as well. However, having said that, you know, why is Obama invested in the Middle East peace process? You know, why are we concerned about China? It's because there is that element of foreign policy that's important in, you know, particularly elections. And so, you know, this is something that policymakers have to watch. And we certainly don't want to see a downturn in our economy again, because we have been recovering and the recovery has been very shaky. And, you know, Obama is still trying to get steps taken to improve on that, as we talked about in the first part of the show. And, you know, so this is something that really bears a lot of watching, but I'm not really sure that the American public is yet really paying attention to it in terms of domestic politics. Mm-hmm. They're kind of not invested in that yet.
An interesting side note, apropos China, as we end this program, Trellis Earth Products, making bioplastic serviceware, moving its manufacturing operations from China to Rochester, New York, to get closer to customers, to cut costs. This is an interesting switch. The company says it's going to join a growing list of manufacturers leaving China because of rising energy and labor costs. It sells to U.S. customers, transporting finished goods back to the U.S., canceled out any benefits of being located in China. We'll leave that little side note news and our discussion with David Skidmore of Drake University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you both for joining us on this Politics Wednesday.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll remember one of our nation's most highly decorated servicemen, a tireless advocate for veterans' rights, also a native of Iowa, of Sioux City. Retired Colonel George Bud Day died at the age of 88. We'll remember him tomorrow on this program. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. And Cedar Falls, help from Tony Daner. Des Moines, help from John Pemble. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.